care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this 23rd day of November 2010. And this is Bill Cable from Mediate Now, and in the studio with me is Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Yes, good morning, Bill. Good morning, listeners.
Well, we've got a huge show today. We are looking forward to speaking to Steve Bidoff, the author of The New Manhood. And Steve has written a number of books over the years which have been international bestsellers. Steve's had live talks with a phenomenal public response. He's reached over 130,000 people in 27 countries. So it's going to be great speaking to Steve about his new book. And we'll also be speaking with David Hatfield, who's the Canadian coordinator for International Men's Day. And David is running a number of very good programs in Canada, in particular one called Manology. So it'll be great to talk to David when we cross all the way over to Canada. Now, speaking of International Men's Day, the International Men's Day was last Friday, the 19th. The celebration of Movember, of course, is still going until the 30th of November. And next week we will be having a wrap-up of events on celebrating International Men's Day, and we'll be speaking with Diane Sears in the US. She's the coordinator of all the USA activities. And we'll be speaking with Warwick Marsh, who is the media spokesman for Australia. And on that topic, I'd like to say a big cheerio to Jason Thompson. Jason's been doing a lot of work for IMD. He's the historian and the global website manager for IMD. And I know he's put in an awful lot of work over the last month. So all the best, Jason, and keep up all that good work. Only a few days to go. So still on the Movember theme, I noticed that Target is a sponsor, a proud sponsor of Movember. So anyone out there who goes into Target and buys any Mr. Mo T-shirt, will 25% of the retail sales will go to the Movember Foundation. And as we've said before, the Movember is supporting this year prostate cancer and also depression, well, treating depression for men, as well as a range of other health activities. So a very important cause for Movember. Now, it's been a big week in the news. Ian, have you got something for us?
Oh, look, I've got a couple of things here. They're both tragic. Firstly, of course, there's been that mining disaster over in New Zealand. In the Sunday Telegraph, under the headline "Prayers for a Dad-to-be," Yoni Bashan has written, "The pregnant girlfriend of trapped Australian miner Josh Uffer sat glued to the television yesterday, praying the father of her unborn child would emerge unscathed." I won't read the rest. It's a very tragic story. An unborn child who looks like there's a very strong possibility he may be born into the world with no father at all, which is an absolute tragedy. Of course, our hopes and prayers for everybody here, Dads on the Air, go out to the families of the trapped miners in New Zealand, and we hope, like the Chile situation and like the situation in China, where 29 miners emerged from the mine unscathed over the weekend, let's hope we have a miracle. And it does seem like we need a miracle in this case, for those miners to all come out alive and unharmed.
Yes, of course, that's your homeland, Ian. You might have a special feeling, but we're all hoping that those miners underground get out. But as each hour goes past, I think the news is not looking good.
No, it's not looking good. The New Zealand police have actually started, discussing things in grave terms, which is not, you know, that particular word does have very negative connotations. Another one here, my last words, be safe, Dad's birthday caution. This is to do with the Belangolo Cemetery, I think it should be renamed. Late on Saturday afternoon, David Alcioloni phoned his eldest son to wish him a happy 17th birthday and make sure he stayed safe that night. His son, David Jr., had spent the day at his grandparents' home in the Southern Highlands and was planning to go out with mates that night for a low-key celebration. Just hours later, David was dead. And, of course, there is a link to a relative of Ivan Milat, in this particular case, who was, of course, the the Belangolo murderer who murdered seven tourists and buried their remains in Belangolo State Cemetery. A very, very tragic story. No silver lining to that black cloud. This young lad murdered on his 17th birthday. Can't imagine the shock and horror. So, of course, our commiserations go out to the family, the father and the mother in this case, and all of the family who must be suffering terribly.
And as the world was celebrating International Men's Day on Friday, 19 November, a leading health researcher, Professor McDonald from the University of Western Sydney, while congratulating initiatives like the hugely successful Movember campaign, notes that it is worth remembering that many health problems can be tackled cost-effectively with well-researched and resourced social programs. Professor McDonald will be joining world-leading health researchers in Perth, Western Australia, to discuss the latest trends at a meeting soon, and there is going to be a conference in Sydney in September 2011. For people that would like some more information on that conference, go to the website www.workingwithmen.org.au. And on the subject of conferences, we've had a frequent guest on the show, representatives from the Australian Men's Sheds Association, and they are going to be having their fourth national conference. It's going to be on the 21st to the 23rd of August 2011, and it will be held in Brisbane. For more information on this conference, go to www.menssshed.org, or you can go to go to menssshed.org is probably the easiest way. So that's if people want to find some more about that. And just while we're looking for some other news events, there's been another abduction that's been reported, this one not from Australia, but from the USA, and it is a situation where a father in Florida was going through the arrangements with his ex-wife to know to find in connection with his 8-year-old son. He started getting worried when his 8-year-old son's cell phone went straight to voicemail. He then rang the mother. It went to voicemail as well. He tried her office line, voicemail everywhere. So in all this confusion, he involved the police, and next thing you know, he found out that the child had been taken to South Africa. The mother's lawyers are arguing whether it was abduction or kidnapping, but it is in breach of the US law, and the distraught father has said everyone's referring to this as a David and Goliath case, because every time we go in the courtroom we win, but the child is still not there. Unfortunately, the mother went off with a very wealthy South African, so money is not an object for them, but it is for the father. I might just mention also, we've had on the program previously an interview with Dr. Richard Warshak, who is the guru of parental alienation throughout the world. And if people would like to go to our website, www.dadsontheair.net, you can search back for that interview with Richard Warshak. And also, Richard has announced that he's started a blog on his website, and this is in connection with his DVD that we've also spoken about on the program called Welcome Back Pluto. So for people that would like to follow that blog, go to the website www.warshak, that's warshak.com, and you can also follow Dr. Warshak on Twitter at www.twitter.com/RichardWarshak, one word. That's Richard, Warshak. Just in Australia, one other item here on International Men's Day, you might mention that on the Gold Coast, Gold Coast Mayor Ron Clark, who of course is well known for his sporting exploits, said International Men's Day was a time to reflect on male role models in their lives and to reinforce the need for men to take better care of their health and well-being. Event organisers have listed 6 principles behind their event, and it's good to see that the Gold Coast Mayor is getting behind them.
Well, another one here. Whilst we stay with a bit of tragedy, of course, Schoolies Week, papers have been full of pictures of basically children covered in blood from brawls. Turning Byron into Bay of Pigs was the heading in yesterday's Telegraph. Jeff Chambers has written, they came to Byron Bay to escape the drunken fights and seedy hotels and surfers' paradise. By noon on Saturday, more than 10,000 schoolies had overrun the tourist haven. By midnight, they were brawling with local kids on Main Beach. Obviously, all of it alcohol-fueled. You know, you just got to wonder where this... I mean, they've gone off to celebrate. They've had a successful year at school. This is supposed to be a celebration, and it turns to tragedy. Children admitted to hospital with, you know, with injuries from brawls, bashing each other. It's shocking. It's a sign of, you know, social breakdown. They used to be the good old days. They used to go and, you know, have a few beers and celebrate together. Now it turns into a brawl. Also, lots of drugs. The police have been confiscating drugs. They've got sniffer dogs, and they're finding a lot of these kids with, you know, various drugs, marijuana, ecstasy, all the party drugs are represented. And it's, you know, it's really is getting out of hand.
Yes, we're trying to work out the other day when this schoolies tradition started. It may have been in the early 90s, but it certainly seems to have taken over now, and the Gold Coast is the centre of it. But I think some young people, certainly someone in my family I know, decided to avoid all the excesses that you see on the Gold Coast and went for a quiet week or weekend in Melbourne, which sounded...
a lot more sensible, a lot safer as well. I mean, what are you supposed to do? I guess if you're with a bunch of mates and, you know, everybody decides that they want to get drunk, I mean, I guess a lot of kids would just be swept along in the tide. I mean, I would assume most of them are not interested in getting drunk and having fights. But, you know, once again, it's a minority who've got their picture all over the paper, who, you know, cause problems for the majority, and the whole thing is getting a pretty bad name.
Yeah, no, just coming back to International Men's Day, one celebration which we hadn't noted before, but on the relevant day, on the 19th of November, which, by the way, is the day for International Men's Day every year. It was set up, when it was first set up, it was that was the day, and on 19th of November 2010, I noticed that in Hong Kong, to celebrate International Men's Day, men were allowed to, or men were with a valid identity card, could enjoy a day of free round-trip cable cars up to the top of the mountain. So I guess it's a long way to go for a free ride, but any men in Hong Kong celebrating International Men's Day, I don't know if that's going to become an annual event, but it was great to see that being recognised by the authorities in Hong Kong. Now, just looking forward to future shows, our own John Stapleton has written a book, and the book is called Chaos at the Crossroads. It's not available yet. We're hoping it will be available in the next few weeks, and we're also hoping to interview John perhaps on the December 7 show, but we'll keep you advised about that. But it'll be interesting to hear what John's thoughts are after at least 10 years on Dad's on the Air, and I think a bit longer than that involved in men's activities. So, yeah, it'll be great to talk to John.
Okay, well, we'll just go to a quick break, and we'll be back after the break with Steve Bidolf.
It's not time to make a change. Just relax, take it easy. You're still young, that's your fault. There's so much you have to know. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old, but I'm happy. I was once like you are now, and I know that it's not easy to be calm when you found something going on. But take your time, think a lot. Why, think of everything you've got, for you will still be here tomorrow, but your dreams may not. How
often I try to explain. When I do, he turns away again. It's always been the same, same old story. From the moment I could talk, I was ordered to listen. Now there's a way, and I know that I have to go away. I know I have to go. Not time to make a change, just sit down, take it slowly. You're still young, that's your fault. There's so much you have to go through. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old, but I'm happy. Keeping all the things I knew inside. It's hard, but it's harder to ignore it. If they were right, I'd agree. But it's them they know, not me. Now there's a way, and I know that I have to go away. I know I have to go.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress, 1300 853 437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air this 23rd day of November 2010. And our guest now is Steve Bidoff. Steve is one of the world's best-known psychologists, and his books include Secret of Happy Children, Manhood, and Raising Boys. He was voted Australian Father of the Year in 2000. And now, 16 years after releasing Manhood, Steve has produced The New Manhood, the handbook for a new kind of man. Stephen, are you there?
Yes, Bill. Nice to be talking to you.
It is great. Last time I saw you, you were doing one of your talks, which have had this phenomenal public response over the years. And look, there's so much to talk about with your new book. I'm not quite sure where to start, but it's perhaps if you could tell us, you know, what you've found in the intervening 16 years that brought you to write The New Manhood.
Sure. I think that the real heart of the matter was waking up to the deep down, this thing of how we create masculinity, how we make men, and that becoming a man isn't something that suddenly happens when you turn 18 and or even 25. In fact, it often doesn't happen at all, and there's lots of boys walking around with beer guts and you know, bald heads.
They don't get older, they just get taller.
Well, yes, and that was a real cause for concern, and so I wanted to start understanding what makes us a man, and that we can stand tall and call ourselves a man. And the difference became really, really clear through reading some of the work of a man called Richard Rohr that some of your listeners will know about. He's a Franciscan monk and writes a lot about this. And what he was pinpointing is that the difference between a boy and a man is that a boy, quite naturally and healthily, is concerned for himself. A boy is interested in how much fun he can have and being heroic and wonderful and admired by everyone, whereas a man moves past that and begins increasingly to focus on living for other people.
There's
and it doesn't mean he becomes a sort of a big martyr or anything like that, Bill, at all. It's that he certainly enjoys life and he loves to be alive in this world, but his main focus increasingly becomes his family, his community, and the world that he lives in. And so he becomes a life preserver and a life giver.
Now, these are the, well, what we would like to see, the ideal man, I guess, and I note from the beginning of your book, you talk about men who wake up in the morning energized and happy, whose partners and children love and trust them, who do work they believe in and enjoy, and a number of other very good things. Are these, do you think these are ideals, or is that still open to men these days?
I think that that they are certainly ideals, but you have to have ideals, and you're right that it is a setting the bar quite high. And in fact, by these criteria, I think I only became a man at about the age of 56, so about 2 years ago. And I'm, you know, it's funny, but I'm deadly serious about that. And I think with what we've terribly let down the young men by not clearly telling them what a man is and helping them to become that. And so, as I said, many men in their 20s and 30s are really behaving like boys. And when I talk to women, that's what they say. They say, you know, we can't find a man who's got his act together, who really knows what he stands for. And so I think it's often only through painful circumstance, and I think a lot of your listeners are particularly aware, sometimes what grows us up is having things go very badly in our lives, and we realize what matters, and we come to that later in life. And so it might be that in the future we don't have to let that happen by chance. We can help teenage boys to get there quicker, but for many of us, it was only tough experience that that brought us into manhood.
Yes, at page 127 of your book, you refer to the five truths of manhood, and I remember that particularly from your talk. This is really a shock treatment for young boys, I suppose, as to what's involved in going the next step. But I wonder if you could perhaps take us through those five truths.
Yes, and you're right; they are quite shocking. And I'd never want to see these written on a blackboard in a school, and I'd never want to see them on a handout piece of paper, because these are the things that you have to be told by elders who care about you and are committed to looking after you, because these are things that boys have begun to suspect as they come into their mid-teens, and I will quickly go through them. The first, of course, is that you're going to die, that one day your life is going to be over, and you never know when that day is going to come. That life, despite what the advertising and the magazines tell you, life is hard, and you will have very hard things happen to you. Even if you live a good life, do all the right things, you will still have unbearable suffering come along, sometimes quite often in your life. That you're not that important. In the scheme of things, you're not a hero, and you're not a fantastic, outstanding, you know, rock star. You're just one of the human race. That your life is not a story about you. And I think this is probably my favorite, because it shifts the focus. And then the final one, just to round them off, is that you can never be completely in control of the outcomes. And so whatever you do, you can greatly improve and choose a good life and choose to do a lot of things right, but still some things will go not according to plan. Now, if boys are helped with those ideas, Bill, then it means that they're not unprepared, that it is confronting, but this is what being a man in the world, and I'm sure you yourself in your life have come to realize all of these things through learning them the hard way. Would that be a fair comment?
It certainly is, and it's amazing how they struck home when you went through those. Because look, there's application in a lot of areas, I think, when you are going to die. Well, I mean, perhaps all these young drivers might come to terms with that before they do silly things on the road. I think there's a lot of application of all those five truths.
Yes, and I think that I guess because I'm older now, I have a lot of feeling and concern for the young men, and looking back on how hard those years were. And I think when you're in your mid-teens, you feel adulthood coming at you, almost like a train coming at you, and it's not a really good feeling. I think that often we don't make adulthood look very appealing to our kids. Mm. It looks like it's a worryful, stressful heap of responsibilities. So it's no wonder they don't really want to step up to the line. And they suspect these things are true. If we don't sort of sit down with them and talk to them, not just dads, but uncles and other men, and say, this is how it is, and life is a very tough gig, but you don't have to deal with it all on your own, that we have a community amongst the men and the women, and we'll welcome you into that, we'll support you as you become a young father, as you have trouble in your marriage, there'll be people to help you to stay thinking clearly and acting with a good heart. And so along with the tough message is a message of welcome to an adult community that is a good place doing good things.
Yes, I'm reminded of a quote from Henry David Thoreau, who said, most men lead lives of quiet desperation and go to the grave with the song still in them. And I think your message is that there is more to a man's life than we've settled for, and we're not just walking wallets and pretending to be fine, and there is something we can do about it.
Yes, and of course Thoreau was living at a time when the world was beginning to industrialize, and he was the famous for he went and lived on Walden Pond, where he got away from society and grew his own food and wrote one of the most wonderful books about self-sufficiency that was ever written. And then he was noticing that at his time men were becoming office workers and working in factories, ruled by the clock, and he saw that quiet desperation, and he was determined to escape from that. I think we're still needing to do that, and men as the walking wallet was one of the things I was almost famous for saying, that we have to find a happier life and be more joyful and be more in community and less worried about this consumer society that gives us a shiny car and takes away our testicles, basically.
Yeah. And I guess we've got an example right in front of us, because women seem to have coped much better in developing themselves. And I think you gave the example, we have stereotypes in our mind of a vibrant, articulate woman, and standing beside her is a self-conscious, stiff and angry man. And we've got to move away from that.
Yes, I think that there's a very good marriage counsellor who's written a lot about this in Western Australia called Noel Giblett. And Noel found that when people came for marriage counselling, that the women found it very easy to talk about their feelings and to talk about the whole situation. And they made sense. And often it would be the counsellor and the woman would be completely, understanding each other. And the man would have real difficulty feeling like he had a point to make. And Noel came up with this understanding that sometimes men have to get into... I'm sorry about that, some noises on the phone, I'm sorry about that. This understanding of that sometimes by talking to other men, and men have said this from reading The New Manhood, that they kind of got their own voice after a while. They thought, hang on, this is how I feel and this is how I function, and that I'm not bad, I just am different. And from that point of view, began to start to be able to speak to their wife with more calmness and with more confidence. And the great thing is that that's what women were wanting as well. That a good woman really likes it if her husband is clear and has a point of view. And isn't that he's aggressive, but that he's confident. And there's something really attractive in someone who's not always just saying, yeah, whatever you like, yes, I'll go along with that. Mm. But says, well, this is what I'd like, and what do you like, and how can we work it out? Does that make sense, Bill?
Yes, it is. And I think, but yet people are scared, or men are scared of doing that for some reason. I think they're perhaps being cowed into their female side so much so that they'll do anything to sort of, oh, they think they'll do anything to keep the other side happy, but actually it's having the reverse result.
Yes, and I can remember being like that for so long, just thinking, if to be lovable I have to be sort of a nobody, and that sort of, and my wife used to get so cross with me because it was like I didn't have a point of view. Mm. I just wanted everyone to like me all the time, and sometimes it's being yourself that is the most important thing. Whether it's as a dad, as a workmate, as a friend, disagreement is real, and then a lot of the chapters in the book become on how to do that. It's how to have disagreement and not have it blow up, because the other thing that happens with our male wiring is we easily get threatened. If we get threatened, we'll just put up the mask, and wearing masks is a very male thing to do. And so it's going to take a generation to really change this, but I think there's huge progress since I've been talking about it for 30 years now, and I think today's young men are a lot different and a lot better at relating to human beings.
Yes, well, I think you give the consumer warning at the start of your book, saying that reading this book has consequences. So and I think a lot of your readers, a lot of people at your talks have, it's brought the emotion out that perhaps they didn't even realise was there for a lot of the men.
Yes, and about one in ten persons who read the book quit their jobs, Bill. So it's sort of major effect. A lot of people go and look up their fathers and have a long talk to them, but leaving a crap job is very often the consequence of reading a bit off book. So be careful, people out there who read it.
Well, yes, and just on that emotion, I mean, I think you say that, and it's a common comment, when you hear about a man committing suicide, people will say, oh, I didn't know he was unhappy. They've no insight into what that man is really, really thinking, which is very sad.
Yes, and I think that one of the things that is really, really important is for friendship to be put around men. There's a story in the book about a man who was having an argument with his wife, and he went out and got on his tractor. He was on a farm, he got on his tractor and sort of headed off at speed, and there was a trailer hitched up, and he didn't know, but one of his a little toddler son had come out running after him when he left the house. He didn't close the door, and the back wheels of the trailer went over his little boy. And the child was actually okay. It was a muddy Victorian farm. It had been raining, and the soil was soft, and it wasn't the trailer didn't have anything on it. And so the boy just had bruises and was all right. But this man was in incredible post-traumatic stress from this. He and everyone just said, it could have happened to anyone. But he was away on a camping trip with an older friend, and after about 4 or 5 days in the bush, he just started talking about this, and his friend said to him this remarkable thing. He said, what did everyone say? And the man said, oh, they just said it could have, you know, it was just an accident. And the old man looked him in the eye and across the campfire and said, well, I think you're a bloody idiot, and you should have been more careful. And the younger man just crumpled, just like pitched forward out of his seat and sobbing on the ground, and the old man went around and held him, and what was, because he knew that was actually true, and the older man wasn't criticizing him, he was just saying, let's be honest here. And the young man told the old man that he'd actually, you know, been so angry with his wife, he hadn't looked back, hadn't checked like he usually would have done, and deep in his heart he knew that, and it was on his conscience. And it needed an honest friend to be able to say, you know, what's the real story here? And so we really need friends. And I think we especially need older friends, Bill. Nice. When we're 60 or 70, we need 80 and 90-year-olds to lean on. I think if we had that, our lives would go so much better. And I don't know if people listening have people like that in their life. And us older guys, I think we've got to get involved with the young men and talk straight to them. And you can support someone and still, you know, be very blunt with them. And that's sometimes what we really need.
And starting, I suppose, with your relationship with your own father, and you've devoted a fair bit of space to that relationship. And I'm interested in the categories you've described, because I think we can all recognise these different types. The biggest categories are the estranged and hurt, the cactus connection, the duty connection, and it comes down to only 10% having that wonderful relationship. But I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that that father-son relationship.
Yes. Well, this was something, Bill, that I began to notice when I started to give my Raising Boys talks, which are the main talk that I've done around the world for about 20 years now, and I'm doing that much less now. I'm starting to wind that down. But even in the early days, when I started talking about men and their fathers in the first half hour of the talk and how things had gone wrong in the 20th century between dads and sons, this incredible thing, I'd be looking out into a theater of people, mothers and fathers, and usually often 500 or 600 people, and I would see tears coming into the eyes of people around the room. Not everybody, but just scattered across the room, people crying. And that's a fairly unusual thing to see in a room full of grown-up parents at a parenting talk. And I just began to realize that this was a really deep wound, and that very many men carried this wound. And as you said, that around about 90% of men are not on great terms with their dads. Some are better than others, but only about one man in 10, if you ask him, will say, yes, I'm close to my father. I talk to him about my problems. We're always on the phone. He's one of my best mates. In fact, he's more than that. He's like a emotional backstop in my world. Now, one in 10 is not a very good success rate. And that made me realize that this wasn't just an individual. People didn't need a psychologist for this. The whole culture was wounded. And this probably was the core message of those 20 years was, let's raise our sons so that we don't have, so they're not crying in a workshop or a seminar 30 years from now, but they are, that's a better statistic. And I think we've actually achieved that. And I think dads today are much closer to their children. And hopefully we've turned the corner with that.
Yes, because I think there might be people out there who think it's okay, it's satisfactory to have that sort of not very good relationship where you see dad perhaps birthdays, holidays, family gatherings, or one up from there might be you see them perhaps once a month, phone regularly, but these are not the relationships that you're talking about, are that where you have that good relationship, are they?
Bill, that's a really thoughtful question, because I think what lots of us thought in the 1990s and so on and the 20th century was bad luck, doesn't matter that I don't get along with my old man, that's just the way it was, I'll make it different with me and my kids. And I think that resolve to make it different is a good idea, but it's like we're wanting to give our sons, and this applies to mothers as well, we wanted to give our boys the full river of healthy masculinity. We want to give them everything about being a fine man. But if we ourselves only ever got a little trickle, then how can we pass on the whole river to our children? And so this idea that sometimes to help our own kids better and to make our lives go well, we have to go back to our dads. And if possible, and it's not always possible, to try and sort out what went wrong. And this is the most strongest and most moving and long-term response to my book has been letters I get from men who've tracked down their dads, carefully and gently begun to explore what went wrong between us. Why did you leave mum, or why did you sort of never have time for us, or what, it might be a particular incident that just completely everything went badly and they've never forgiven them for. And so fixing that relationship is really, really worthwhile. Now, it's not easy, and I've put two chapters in the book just to the, safeguards of how you might go about doing that. And it's not like in the movies, as you know, Bill, it's that things in the movies tie up nice and neatly.
Yes.
And real life is always a bit messier than that. Some men's dads are not even alive anymore. But somehow we have to get the river flowing again. So we have healthy masculinity coming to us and flowing out of us as well. So it's a big question. I'm struggling to put it in words, but I hope that makes some sense to your listeners.
Yes, I mean, that first step is probably going to be the most difficult one of going down that path, fearing the rejection from the father and but you know, persisting. And I think you gave a very good story about a son who actually had to travel interstate to see his father. I wonder if you recall that one.
Oh, which, Bill, which one was that?
Now, I think, was it in Western Australia, and he went to his father on his deathbed?
Oh, yes, that's right. And his dad, he went over specially to talk to his dad, and they had this big fight, and his dad stormed off. And he, nothing he could do about it, so he just had came home again. This is a good friend of mine in Launceston, and he'd only been home 6 weeks when he had a phone message that his father had a heart attack and was not looking like surviving. And he went back to all the way to Western Australia into the intensive care ward and just blasted his father with all the wrong things, you know, just sitting on quietly on the side of the bed, just blasted him, you know, you're not run away from me now, you know. And it was all these specific questions about something his father had said on his 8th birthday and something else, some other decisions he'd made. And to his surprise, his father came back at him with, said, "Now look, sit down, there's some things I want to tell you." And they talked for about 2 hours, and they actually really got it all sorted out. And it was a real last-minute thing. His father only lived for another 2 days. But it was just that, I think, if you put yourself in that picture, when you're old and you know your kids don't really care for you, don't respect you, what could be more important than getting some kind of redemption of that and at least be able to tell your side of the story and come to a peaceful place? I can't think of anything more important. And so don't wait till they're, you know, till they're on their last legs if you possibly can. The simplest question to ask your dad is just, "Dad, I want to hear your story. I'd like to really know what it was like to be a dad. And when we were born, how was it for you?" Because we often haven't got the slightest idea. And in that non-threatening way, we can often get into some really good learning.
Yes, I mean, you could perhaps even run it like a Parkinson interview and to try and get your dad to run through his life in that way. And I mean, people are always interested in talking about their lives, I guess.
Exactly. And if we can hold back on the criticism, there might be things that we want to say, and that might come down the track. But it doesn't seem to work to go and say, "Dad, you're a complete bastard. I just want to tell you I've written 17 pages about how bad you were." For some reason, that doesn't seem to kick it off very well.
No surprise. But, and you see the importance of establishing that relationship with your father as having influence on other areas of your life.
Yes, I think that this is a very deep thing. I think that deep down, you see, our father is our model for maleness, especially in the modern world where we live in nuclear families. It was better when we lived in tribes and you had 7 uncles and 2 granddads and lots of other men around. But growing up in the 20th century, it was mum and dad, that was it. And if you were lucky, you had some others. But so you take in your father's attitudes and his, even his body language. I have ways of moving my arms and standing that are exactly like my father. And there was a time when I would have been horrified to think that. But if he's inside us, and so if we're at odds with him, then I think we're also at odds with ourselves. And we're at war, and he might be 20 years dead, and we're still having this struggle about, you know, my dad doesn't think I'm good enough. And it leads to a lot of compulsive behavior and a lot of not really understanding yourself. Now, whether it's in therapy or whether it's in reading books or whether it's talking to the real person, I think the real person is the best option if you could possibly manage that. Mm. But I think for our whole lives, we're kind of getting our childhood sorted out. And my grandfather was pretty messed up by World War One, and so here we are, you know, 90 years later, some of those things are still, I'm sorting out, you know, to not be bad-tempered, to not use a loud voice to get my way with my children. So it takes a while to fix those things.
Yes, and we're speaking with Steve Bidolf, the author of The New Manhood, The Handbook for a New Kind of Man. Now, Steve, you say that men have to escape from a few things, and I think you list loneliness, compulsive competition, lifelong emotional timidity. What do you mean by compulsive competition? Because that's a pretty big driver in Australian society, particularly.
Yes, okay. Well, there's an instance which a couple of people said they really liked in the book, which was recalling when I used to live in Bellingen, and I'd go for something to get hot, and I'd go to the pool for a swim during the day when I was sitting at a computer desk, and I'd be sitting by the pool, and I'd perhaps be the only person there, and then some guy would come and come to have a swim, and he might have a girlfriend with him, or he might just be on his own, and straight away, I would go into this thing of, who's the best guy? Is he bigger or stronger than me? If he was, I'd think, oh, I wonder what sort of car he drives, and if he's got a girlfriend or a wife with him, I bet I could have a better conversation with his wife than he can. And I think, what's after? And I, you know, this is just a pleasant sunny day. I'm just there for a swim, and there's all this doing this whole number in my head just because some guy showed up. Now, Bill, does that sound crazy to you, or is that?
It is sounds pretty experience? Pretty common experience, I think.
I think that's testosterone does that to a man.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I think after a while I just thought, what's going on here? I'm seeing every other male on the planet as a competitor, and even sometimes as a threat. And now, when I was a kid, often that was true. I lived in a part of England where if you walk down the street, another young guy coming the other way, or another kid when I was a kid, who might just give you a smack in the mouth just because he's having a bad morning. And so it was a bit like that in the playground. There was a lot of violence and things. But another part of it is that he didn't get a lot of praise. And I grew up in the north of England in the 1950s, and people didn't ever give compliments. It was very rare. And if your dad spoke to you, it was always to criticize. And I think what happens then is that you feel like you're always not good enough. You've always got something to prove. And I'm sure everyone listening's been in a conversation where people are talking quite happily away, and then someone comes and joins in. And they're just, everything they say is, I know better, and I'm smarter, and I'm richer, and you just know they've got something to prove. And it's not fun at all to be around that. And so I think that's a male trait that we could do without, that we need to see each other. I know this is part of what your radio program is on about, is as brothers, that we're all brothers and we're all raising the Earth's children and we're all doing the world's work to help the human race to still be here in 100 years' time. And so we really need that feeling of not being in a race, but being in a family. And since I started to do that, and I look at men as brothers, I can be around the scariest bikey, or the snootiest looking, you know, lawyer in a suit, and I see past that now. I know that I can get to the man behind that, and it's, I'm not completely there. You can still press the right buttons, and out comes the old Steve. But it's been a huge improvement to my mental health to look on other men in a friendly way.
Yes, Steve, look, unfortunately we're running out of time, so I might just mention again, your new book is called The New Manhood, The Handbook for a New Kind of Man. Do you have a website where people can go to?
Yes, it's very simple. It's called stevebidoff.com.
That's pretty simple. And we'll be speaking soon to David Hatfield, who's the Canadian coordinator for International Men's Day, and I know he was thrilled to be on the same program as you. He quotes your books in his courses.
Oh, and, he's great, yes.
And I know, as I say, I'm sure he's been listening in the last half an hour in all you've got to say about the new book and life in general. So, Steve, can I thank you most sincerely on behalf of Dazzle and the Air for coming on the program, and we wish you all the very best with your book and your courses in the years to come as you get closer to 60.
Thanks for the great discussion, Bill. That was really nice to talk to you.
Thank you very much. All right, that's Steve Bidoff, and we'll be back shortly.
The road is long, with a many a winding tongue that leads us to who knows where, who knows where.
he ain't heavy. He's my brother. So on we go. His welfare is my concern. No burden is he to bear. We'll get there. For I know he would not encumber me. He ain't heavy. He's my brother. It's a long, long road from which there is no return. While we're on the way to there, why not share?
So fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back. With Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this 23rd day of November 2010. And our next guest is David Hatfield, who is the Canadian Coordinator for International Men's Day. David is an independent facilitator, an experiential educator, trainer and consultant, whose professional issues revolve around issues of social justice, masculinity and leadership. David, are you there?
I'm here.
Great. Look, it's great to talk to you. How is it in Canada at the moment?
Well, all things considered, weather-wise, I'd rather be where you are.
Yeah, 27...
About 4 below...
Yeah,
go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, it's 27 degrees here.
Well, you're about 31 degrees higher than here, I'll put it that way.
Now, David, you were the coordinator for International Men's Day on the 19th of November. I wonder if you could give us a little bit of an outline of what happened in Canada on the big day.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And it's a pleasure to be on your show today. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you.
We had a really great experience here in Vancouver, and maybe I'll finish with that. there was a small event that went down in Ontario in one of the smaller municipalities near Toronto. And I haven't been able to connect with the coordinator yet, but we'll be speaking in a couple of days. Then there was an unexpected event in Winnipeg, which is in the mid, sort of mid-Canada. And that one I was told about actually by the International Men's Day global website coordinator, Jason Thompson, who's based in Sydney.
Yes.
And it's a beautiful story of a 25-year-old organization that works with women who've been through a trauma in childhood. And the partnership of that organization with the Winnipeg Men's Resource Center. And this was news to me. I didn't know about it. So I thank Jason for turning me on to that story. The acknowledgement on Men's Day was that the two organizations are now working collaboratively together in the same building. And for anybody of your listeners, Bill, who's been involved or has knowledge of the domestic shelter situation for women, this is, at least in Canada, this is absolutely groundbreaking that that those spaces are often quite fiercely defended as female-only, and I totally understand why it's been that way. But that this one center has said, you know, like, we want to work with men. And so they're actually offering their services and expertise to men who've been through sexual abuse.
Yes, it's the same story. Sorry, David, I was just going to say it's the same story in Australia, and I think it's the same in England, and it's probably the same in the States. It seems to be a worldwide phenomenon which people are just waking up to.
Yeah. So a wonderful story there. The intermediate sort of blanket story of International Men's Day here in Canada is one I'm still trying to wrap my head around, and that is that through the year, I was invited to be the Canadian coordinator in January this year, so I had almost a year to run up to Men's Day. And I sent out a number of emails to various organizations that I either knew about or found online or people told me about that might have an interest in Men's Day. And most of them were men's organizations of one form or another. And the response I got was almost zero. It was almost flatline from a number of these men's health organizations, organizations for abusive men, men's resource centers, etc. And I was really surprised by that. So I'm not at all sure what the response was or why there was a lack of interest. In one case, a men's resource organization in Ontario, one of their members got back to me and was very enthusiastic, and then was actually his own board of the organization voted against observing Men's Day. So it's a bit of a mystery to me, particularly for organizations chronically, at least here in Canada, and I would assume the same for where you are and the countries you just named, struggling for legitimacy, struggling for funding, struggling against being overwhelmed and overworked and burnout, and maybe just folks not recognizing the leveraging that's possible through a United Nations sanctioned day of observance. I'm not really sure. I'm left to sort of make up a story about it.
Yes, I think certainly we need some more publicity in Australia. Not a lot of people know about the Movember, but not so much about International Men's Day. But perhaps, how did you become involved in this men's work, David?
Well, if I could, I'd love to tell you about the Men's Day event here in Vancouver, because that's the crowning one, and then I'd be happy to answer your further question.
Yes.
We had a really great event here in Vancouver. So we had 18 organizations that I invited who operate in the Vancouver area or close by, who already work to support boys, men, and families, with a real strong focus on, obviously, looking at masculinity issues, masculinity-focused support services. And that alone, I think, was a kind of calling card for a lot of folks in the community, and especially in the media, to feel like, hey, something's happening. Let's go check this out. So we had a good turnout of people coming to the event. We had some entertainers. We had a lot of media, including a Chinese television station was there. I'm not sure exactly how they found out about it, but that was great to have them. And I feel like the thing was a great success. One of the highlights I'd love to share with your listeners, and this just shows me again after 13 years of doing masculinity work, how much I still have to learn about educating myself and getting past my own assumptions about what I think men are about and what they're not about. So one of the organizations that came to Men's Day was a local yoga studio that has created something called Broga, which is male-specific yoga. and they wanted to do a demo at Men's Day, and I said, sure, go for it. And so when we actually got to the space, we had to look around, we decided that they should do it from the stage. And to my amazement, when they got up there and they had one of them was speaking through the movements, the postures, and the other guy was actually doing the motion, like doing the postures so people could see. And there was 30 or 40 people doing yoga along with these folks. They were standing, simple poses you could do with regular clothing on. And they did it twice during the event that day, and had a huge turnout of people going for it. So all of a sudden, all the cameras, of course, are catching these men in these beautiful poses, warrior and tree and so on. And I was just shaking my head laughing, going, this is fantastic. But there were some good highlights there.
Yeah, that sounds good. So Vancouver is moving along with International Men's Day anyway. There's getting a good response there by the sound of it.
Yeah, it was heartening. And I think we were not able to get any funding for the event this year, so it was a bare-bones version. But I think with the good turnout, and we've got a bit of a track record now, and I made good and sure that we had some videographers and photographers there to document the work. I've got some written materials that people produced. We had some stations where people, like, for example, writing messages to their father and
yes.
Echoing the power of what Steve was saying earlier in the program.
Mm.
A lot of emotionality coming out on some of those just simple pieces of construction paper posted to a wall, but trying to engage people's own voices and own stories as part of the event.
Yes, and it's great.
On that level.
It's great that you were able to get the proclamation. I think that's from the City of Vancouver. I think that's a good move, which we haven't really got onto in Australia yet, but that seems like a good thing to do to get that recognition.
Yeah, it does go into the official ledgers of things. There was also another proclamation in Ontario, and the state of Michigan in the United States did their actual senator for the state did one. So all this goes into the official record. So it's a way of, again, legitimizing this work in an official level. And again, each time it's mentioned or each time there's a declaration, as you know, there's a bit more, another little ripple of consciousness goes out into the world about the world of men, what's happening, and that there's organizational infrastructure being developed to support boys and men, and that from the government to the support services and healthcare and so on, that a lot of people are thinking about this and carrying on and building these things. And I think that's an important message.
Yes, we can only hope it snowballs in future years. So just coming back, David, perhaps you could tell us something about your own involvement with men's work over the last, did you say, 10 years or so?
Yeah. I'd have to give a nod to my father to start. He wasn't exactly a men's work guy, but he did attend for a number of years a men's conference. It was based in his church, so it was a church conference more, or at least half as much as a straight-up men's conference. But it kind of got that into my consciousness. When I moved out to Vancouver as a younger man, I was 21 when I moved here, there was sort of the first wave, if you will, of men's movement work in the United States here with Robert Bly's book, Iron John, sort of galvanizing people into their groups. And so I never attended any of those gatherings, but I knew some men who were. And there was something about the way they talked about men's issues that was extremely attractive to me. It made sense, tapped into that longing Steve was talking about just being around more older men. And so I had the typical reaction of being attracted to that and enjoying it. But as many young men, even at the current time, lack a sufficient enough, I guess, level of engagement through a person to actually sort of physically show up and get involved. So I didn't really have a good contact person that I knew and trusted that was really involved on a deep level. The next sort of point of contact for me was in my early 30s. And this is where everything came to a head. I was working for an organization in Vancouver that was doing sexual assault and violence prevention work with young people in schools, high schools, and we separated the genders to do that work. And after doing it for a while, I was brought aside by my boss, who'd begun that organization some 25 years before, and she said to me, I'd like to make you a business partner because you're really into this and you're really good at it, and I'd love to, you know, let's make this bigger, let's grow it. And I just sort of left my career as a musician at that point and was happy to be offered this opportunity. So she said to me, I want you to think critically about the program and what we're up to and make changes, you know, like feel free to innovate and create because I know that that's a gift that you have. So
that comment was the beginning of the end, really. Because what I started to see right away was that the girls and the boys programs were not complimentary in their emotional tone or their messaging. And my increasing discomfort with that became a real place of contention and conflict between my business partner, who'd also become my best friend at that point. So the long and the short of it is, with nothing really happening, the conversation really drying up, and my consciousness really expanding about not only what I thought boys needed, but what I personally wanted to offer to them, clearly it didn't make sense for me to stay at that organization. So this is where the whole story comes closer to where you are. In 2003, around this time in 2003, I came down to visit one of my sisters who lives in just outside of Auckland in New Zealand, and connected with, unbeknownst to me, this incredible level of men's work going on in Australia and New Zealand. And as part of that trip, I actually listened to Steve Bidulph in Melbourne speak on his Raising Boys book, and had a number of experiences with the Essentially Men Network in Australia, in New Zealand, which some of your listeners might know about, and took part in my first Pathways to Manhood program also in New Zealand. And so I came back extremely stoked about what I'd seen, and had been given a lot of mentorship by many men down in New Zealand, and seen the power of a real thriving men's network. And I still feel like Australia and New Zealand are so far ahead of Canada in so many ways with this work. I'm grateful to have the ongoing connection from my own learning and inspiration. So anyway, I came back to Vancouver and basically rolled up my sleeves and got started. I had no business card, no website, I had debt, I had no business plan, but I had a fire. And so I've been riding that fire and trying to figure out how to be smarter about doing so for the last 7 years or so.
Yes. Oh, well,
that's pretty much the story.
That's good to hear your impressions of Australia and New Zealand in this area, but it was in the fall of 2009 that you set up the Manology, Exploring 21st Century Masculinity.
And that was a really response to recognizing I had to break yet another isolation pattern of my own, which was the mythic hero riding into the Wild West and saving the town from negative masculinity. So I decided that I had to create a new structure. And I also wanted to, as part of that, with my isolation of working alone, I wanted to work very consciously and intentionally with other instructors. So I created a format where there could be many guest instructors coming through, and was open to developing a team. But the other part was responding to the models I'd seen and heard about and read about. And this is where I'd veer into. The full title of the Manology course is Manology, Exploring 21st Century Masculinity. It was interesting to hear Steve talk about that 20th century lens a lot, and I liked what he had to say, and I fully agree with him.
Mm.
So I'm a few years younger than most of the men's work leaders that I've known and worked with. I'm just turning 47 next week.
Well, we'll get an early happy birthday, Dave.
Hey, thanks, brother. So I wanted to move away from the sort of weekend retreat or the big pull away from family and community and from usual daily life. And I wanted to make something that was more ongoing so that men could keep coming back and be a part of it in a more longitudinal sense. I wanted it to be cheap so that any man, hopefully, or most men, could afford to be there and create more opportunities for the simplicity of just making friendships. So Manology is an ongoing drop-in course where any Monday night a man can show up for $13 and spend, 2.5, 2.75 hours with an open-hearted circle of men looking at a particular theme that night.
Yes, I think you've noted that while Western women have been redefining their roles in society, there are very few places where men can just come and examine and redefine their roles and their relationships and their sense of purpose. And Manology is the place.
Pardon me?
And Manology is the place. Well, at least if you live in Vancouver, I guess.
Well, I'm hoping over time to create... at this point with Manology, we're trying to really capture the essence of what the curriculum should be. So this is not an academic men's course by any stretch. It's men's work. It's experiential, it's interactive and participatory. And the word Manology is more cheeky than anything. But it's really, the studying of our own experience in manhood.
I'm trying to figure out ways to engage more young men in it, so I'm talking to the universities and the colleges, trying to get some media articles through them and get some talks there, and just figure out exactly, well, why would a man show up on a Monday night? He could be doing a lot of other things. Why would he come down here instead of watching a movie or hanging out or whatever he might be up to and spend time intentionally with other men? So we're in a process of honing the instructor pool and the topics, the kinds of themes that have the most resonance and use for men. And over time, what I'd love to be able to do is kind of share the learning with other communities. And of course, you know, within any community, an organization can, or a group of people who want to run something like this can plug in the needs that they perceive in their own community. But there's a lot of sort of systemic learning and infrastructure building learning that I'm doing as a result of trying to build this Manology program. And I really hope to be able to share it with others who might have an interest. Yeah.
It's directed at men age 19 and older. Was there some reason why you picked the age of 19?
Well, in BC, in the province that I live in Canada, that's the legal age of consent, so that's adulthood. And I love working with young people. I still am very involved in youth leadership work, rites of passage work, and lots of work here with boys and young men. The simple premise on that for Manology was that there's an insurance policy at the community center that we use, and it totally changes if we bring underage youth into it. And so when I first started the program, I just thought, I don't want to take on that level of complexity right now. So let's just focus. I'd be really happy to, let's just focus on adult men. I'd be really happy to have men in their 20s here, and we're starting to have a few, which is great. Also, I think it's just a really tough sell, as Steve alluded to a little bit. The paradigm we're used to is that the younger people, not just boys and young men, but younger people are it's considered normal to just not have an interest, not have much of an active interest in older people. As you said, it's hard for us as adults to make looking adult look cool or look compelling or engaging for a lot of young folks. They just see us stressed out and running around and actually wearing our pants around our waists in the case of boys. So that can be sort of not very attractive. And from my own work with boys and young men, I'm very clear on that. So over time, I'd like to see bridging the gap there. And how I hope to do it over time is to actually be running and coordinating rites of passage programs here, similar to the Pathways to Manhood program, you know, where you are.
Yes.
And having the boys and men engaged through that kind of lens, that kind of experience, and then making having an invitation for the boys who've been a part of that, the young men, to be a part of things like Manology, where now you've had this powerful experience in a circle of men. If you want to keep going on that, if you want to stay connected to these men, and we'd love you to, then we need to create a pathway for you to be able to do that easily.
Yes, and we're speaking...
That's kind of a longer-term vision.
Thank you, and we're speaking with David Hatfield, who is a Canadian coordinator for International Men's Day. David, I wonder if you could just hold on for a moment. A few other things I'd like to talk to you about, but we might just go to a short music break.
Absolutely. Be happy to, Bill.
Thanks, David.
The time has come to shed a tear. This perfect love will bleed. Too close to see the damage done, but now I know I'm in need. I tried and lost, I'll find. We can fly higher. Our hearts will soar over. This mountain of love will open the doors up, and then you'll see a perfect tune. A perfect tune.
years go by and nothing's changed. The signs have come and gone, and what we knew was lost in space. The thief of time points and laughs. We'll let it be to chance alone. We thought
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this 23rd day of November 2010, and we're speaking with David Hatfield, who's the Canadian Coordinator for International Men's Day. David, just coming back to International Men's Day, did you find that the reaction of men to International Men's Day, was it all positive, or did you get any negative feedback about it?
Well, not surprisingly to me, no. There was lots of folks. I had some contact with some folks who had questions about it, and I know some of the people I was working with and some of the organizations who participated also had some questions. And it makes sense to me. I really expected that. If I could sum it up in a phrase, it would be some folks, you know, seeing a poster or hearing about Men's Day and saying something along the lines, well, you know, what's up with this? I mean, isn't every day Men's Day?
Mm.
And I know that some of the other national coordinators and regional coordinators from Men's Day have heard that. So what people are referring to there, I believe, and I perceive, is men's privilege through time, men in the face of so many stories about men's violence, men's bad behavior, etc. Why would we possibly want to dedicate a day to celebrating and acknowledging celebrating men? So in my address to the group at Men's Day here in Vancouver, I referenced that, and like any other international day of celebration, like for women or for Children's Day, Day of Disabled People, etc., I feel like Men's Day has the same sort of charter and the same kind of idea and goal, which is it's not a day to criticize really anybody. It's a day to acknowledge, and in the case of Men's Day, acknowledging the positive contributions made by just average men, you know, decent men living a good life. Also a chance to recognize the challenges faced by boys and men. And that's something that I think Steve covered really well, that in the general sense of the way we make men and what's different and challenging, difficult and challenging within that. So I think what's special about Men's Day, though, is that there is this shadow that has been so needed to illuminate to make social change in the 21st century through the women's movement. It's been a great inspiration to me personally. But not to dwell on the negative at Men's Day. It actually is a day of celebration.
Yes, I was just going to say, it's not a day for putting women down or children down or anyone else down. It's really just for promoting men, isn't it?
Yeah. But I think to be sensitive and to be critical in thinking that acknowledging that question, isn't every day Men's Day, or something along those lines, for me anyway, was definitely something that I felt needed to be done. And as the Canadian coordinator, that's something that I took on at Men's Day. So making an acknowledgement of that and acknowledging that voice or that question that people might have and saying, we know about that, we work with men, and all the same, today's about something different about men. So acknowledging that voice, but focusing on the positive.
So the first step is the acknowledgement, and then what do you see as it should be happening now for 21st century masculinity?
Well, in writing the website content for my manology course about a year and a half ago, this whole other aspect of men's work came up for me. And I don't think it's particularly rocket science new for anybody who might be listening, but just connecting these dots might be something that hopefully that folks maybe haven't thought about before or in the same way as I hadn't before I started doing that writing. So for me, a 21st century masculinity and 21st century men's work its end game is not about masculinity and men's work. So for me, I see it as this century is offering us challenges of a magnitude and speed that have never been seen before, is what people are telling us over and over again. And so for me, that what's required in the 21st century is higher resilience in community, higher cohesion in community. And this is, I loved what Steve Biddulph was saying about this earlier in the program. I couldn't agree with him more. I'll drop in this quote now from Melodoma Somme, who lots of your listeners will know. He's an author and educator. And his quote on masculinity is, "The face of modern masculinity is isolation." And what's been alarming to me and important to respond to is this idea that if men are inwardly struggling in silence often and alone, how can we possibly get it together as a community to take on and succeed at something as complicated as climate change?
Yes.
So my contribution is I'm called to work with men and boys and explore masculinity. So that's my contribution. That's my strand of the weave in the larger fabric that we're all trying to create, which is a peaceful and sustainable society and world. So for me, those are 21st century values that masculinity, the kind of masculinity work that I'm doing, is a part of. So I'm not only inviting men to come down on Monday nights to Manology, I'm inviting them to carpool or take transit, and not get too focused on navel-gazing as men as the end goal of this. That's not what it's about. So, for example, one of my designing challenges in the Manology course is to get us out of the room and into the community. So how can we be in service? And as the weather warms up in the spring, that's where I'd like us to be, is meeting at the place we usually do, at the community center downtown, but then going into the community together as a group of men and offering guidance, support, help, fun, creative energy, whatever we can, to the greater good,
Now, you want to get beyond that community center to a Vancouver Men's Center, I believe.
I couldn't quite hear that.
Oh, sorry. I believe you want to get beyond the local community center and to actually develop a Vancouver Men's Center.
Yeah, this was, again, another sort of outburst of creative thinking after deciding to break my own work isolation and stop working alone. Was to again look at what's already out there for men, what's working well, what's not working well, and what's the next evolutionary step. And for me, it came very quickly as a men's center. So again, drawing a lot of inspiration from New Zealand here, the men's center idea I'm currently working with has three parts. The first part is men's health. So in similar ways that New Zealand and Ireland, and this may be true in Australia too, I don't know, I'd love to see some standalone men's health clinics where, like in Vancouver here, we have a whole hospital, BC Women's Hospital. And I actually used to work there when I first moved here. It had a different name then. But there's so much data about men's poor health and so little funding, so little research. So a place to consolidate and synergize the practitioners who are most interested in working with men, the researchers who are most interested in getting data on men, and normalizing it, because one of the biggest problems with men's health is men don't go to the doctor. So I think when men see a men's standalone health clinic in town, it touches something in us, like, hey, that's for me. I could go in there. The second part is the kind of thing I'm doing with Menology. So this is actively exploring masculinity as a legitimate subject of study. But doing this in this potentially, I'm not really stuffed on how it has to be,
but I think more men would probably be more interested in a non-academic study of masculinity. So studying the male experience through group work, through activities, through outings, through doing some intentional work, some initiatory work, and so on. And then the third part is professional development training for practitioners who work with a significantly male population or would just like to improve their ability to connect with and engage more than anything, engage more males into their workplace. So this has huge ramifications for the school system, for health and social services. I know the demographics between, you know, Australia and Canada and the other countries you named earlier, the English-speaking Western nations, are very, very similar and feature a lot of the same hallmark issues and problems. And one of them is just getting men to engage in the services that already exist.
Now, David, I know you've got a background as in sport and also music. Do you think they're important to develop in men in general?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of men, and this is true for myself as a young man, I was just writing about this earlier today for my course tonight. I think some of my earliest spiritual experiences were almost exclusively through sport and playing music. And it was all about, in music at least, there's no opposition. Nobody's trying to stop you from succeeding. And so there's a team, it's called a band. And in sports, it's called a team, but there is another team trying to stop you. But the bonds that are formed, the style of communication that goes on in team sports, which is what I was interested in, I was a basketball player, still am a basketball player. I think those are really powerful for men. And for boys, I think the challenge is for a lot of us, and I put myself in this category as well, once high school is finished, unless you're pursuing sort of sport or music professionally, for a lot of us it falls off the radar. And there's no working in a business environment with men, I think for a lot of men would say it doesn't quite feel the same way, that carefree, enjoyable, for the love of it kind of thing. So I really am searching for ways and searching for ways to help bring men together in a creative way or creative expression that helps men connect to spirituality, which I loosely define as simply a connection to something far larger than ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. David, we're running out of time, unfortunately, but I know you quote from the Talmud as being the echo of your work, and I've just got it here that do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Do justly now, love mercy now, walk humbly now. You are not obliged to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it. So, David, we might have to end on that note, but could I thank you very much for coming on the program and for all your good work on International Men's Day, and we wish you all the best with the future of manology.
Thank you very much, Bill. It's been a pleasure to speak with you, and I'm really impressed again that you've got a radio show just for dads. You've got a phone line as one of your phone line distress call, phone in line for men. Amazing things that don't exist here yet. So I thank you for the inspiration today.
Thank you. We'll be in touch again. It'd be great to have you on the show and see how we develop in the two countries. So once again, David Hatfield, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Bill.
Bye-bye. Well, we can hear the music. That means
means it's all over, Bill.
It's all over for another week. But we'll be back next week with a great big show. And in the meantime, if you want to hear the show again, you can go to our website, www.dadsontheair.net. Don't forget to stay tuned now for Country On with Country Bob. Until next week, this is Bill Cable. On behalf of Ian Purdy, we say goodbye for now.
Yes, goodbye.
We're dead.